On today's episode of Freedom from Addiction, we are going to be talking about a very important subject with Dr. Larry Westrick, and he is an addiction psychiatrist, and we'll be talking about his new book, which is entitled A Parent's Guide to Teen Addiction. And everybody knows that addiction is a terrible problem in this country, and we're going to get a little insight from Dr. Westrick about his perspective. So, Dr. Westrick, how long have you been practicing addiction psychiatry?
I've been in practice since 1995, so quite a while now.
And why did you get into that genre of psychiatry?
Well, I trained in New York City in the early 90s, and it was kind of the height of the crack epidemic and HIV, and I was on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and I was really fascinated with the problem. I had some excellent mentors who were really helping people with crack cocaine addiction, and I was impressed and wanted to go along and started on that process doing research, and I just got enthralled with the whole field.
I see. Well, let me ask you a basic problem. The medical model tells us that in order to satisfactorily treat a disease, and you consider addiction a disease, don't you?
Yes.
That you need to know the cause of it. In other words, if a patient has pneumonia, you need to know whether it's a bacterial pneumonia or one caused by a virus or one caused by something else before you can effectively treat that disease. So my question to you is, what is the cause of addiction?
Well, you know, the way I express that and what I talk about with patients is that that's usually individual to the person. I think there are many causes for addiction as there are human beings. And so that is certainly something to explore and work on with the patient as they get into recovery. But I find that on a patient-by-patient basis, we have to find out exactly the answer to that question.
Okay. I've been working in the field for 30 years, and my take on this is that the cause of all addictive behaviors, and I'm working with over 30 different behaviors now, the cause is a combination of two things. One, low self-esteem, and that low self-esteem or not valuing yourself enough comes from a lack of spiritual consciousness, not knowing who you are, why you're here, what you are here to do, where you're going when you're done, and everything like that. But that doesn't seem to be in line with conventional thinking on addiction, does it?
Well, I think that the idea that all addiction comes from the same place probably wouldn't be in line with the traditional thinking about it, no.
No. But if you had a disease that all the different types of behaviors, whether it be gambling or sex or substance abuse or whatever, could be treated with the same protocol and get the same results, then what would you think?
Asked me if there was some protocol that would treat all the behavioral addictions as well as the substance addictions?
Yes, every type of addiction.
That would be great.
And if it could be treated by the same method and everything, what would that say to you?
I feel like I'm a little bit on the witness stand here. It sounds like a good thing.
Okay. Well, let's talk about a problem that has been in the news a lot. Opioid addiction.
Yes.
Now, we've got president saying it's a national emergency, and we have people saying that the underlying cause of it is too many doctors giving too many opioids out for pain medication, and we know that if a person doesn't get enough opioids, that they go to the street and get heroin and everything. Tell me about your thoughts about opioid addiction in the country now.
Well, unfortunately, I've seen a lot of teenagers in high school and college-age students who are dependent on opioids, often getting that dependency exactly as you said, where they're prescribed opioids from a physician either legitimately or illegitimately, and then moving forward to doctor shopping, and then sometimes moving forward to heroin. So I've seen a lot of that. I think that there is a vulnerability of a certain portion of the population, however they get the first opioids, to become dependent and then move into an addictive mode with their use, where it's impairing their relationships with other people, with their work, their school, their emotional life, and just everything. And I think that that's all too common. And I would agree with the notion that it's been spawned by physicians prescribing too much opioid.
Would you go along with what some states are proposing or have done to limit a physician's ability to write a prescription for opioids longer than 5 days for common pain type problems?
I would, because all of the statutes that I have seen have said that the initial 5-day prescription is what needs to be done. Obviously, in the rare circumstance where someone needs more, the physician could apply for more of an opioid prescription for the individual. But I think in the vast majority of cases, 5 days of an opioid prescription is more than enough, actually.
Okay. Let's talk about alcohol and marijuana. Alcohol is legal, and in most states, marijuana is not. What if it was the other way around? Would you think that's a better solution or not?
It's hard to know, but from a public policy perspective, it probably would be. I'm not sure it's realistic, but it is, from a public policy perspective, it might be less damaging to have marijuana legal and alcohol illegal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you see the country moving toward legalization of marijuana?
Yes, or at least decriminalization. I mean, 30 states have legalized medical marijuana. 9 states in the District of Columbia have legalized recreational marijuana. So that's the way that the trend is going. Whether that trend continues is maybe left to public health people. But it seems to me that it is.
In your book, you talk about dual diagnosis, meaning substance abuse in line also with mental illness. And I had a question about chronic marijuana use, like 10 years every day. Can that cause mental illness?
Well, there's an association between heavy marijuana use and first break psychosis. And so there's certainly a connection between those two entities. Whether marijuana causes that is another question. But I usually say if someone's having psychosis or any even borderline serious psychiatric problem, they shouldn't use something like marijuana because it is a hallucinogenic.
Okay. Now, your book talks a lot about substance abuse in teenagers and how the parents should talk to them about the various different kinds, and you had in your appendix a long list of drug terminology and slang use. I thought that was exceptional. How did you get all that? It must have taken a lot of time to come up with all those names. And
well, a couple of ways. One is I write down very carefully with words teenagers use to describe their drug use, but then there's all kinds of online lists of drug names, and I was an English major in college, so I'm very interested in the words that people use to describe their use of drugs and alcohol. So it's kind of a hobby of mine.
Well, I've never seen that good a list anywhere, and so if you're a parent and you want to know what your kids are taking or thinking about or whatever, go to this book and look in that, and when you hear that slang and everything, you know perhaps more about what they're talking about.
Right.
How do you define tough love with respect to how a parent talks to their teenager about drug abuse?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up, because I think it's so important that the use of the tough love thinking doesn't gets sort of impaired in a way. I mean, and the reason I say this, oftentimes family members, parents of teenagers included, get so angry with the person who's using because that person is often lying to them or stealing from them or cheating or doing things that are far outside of the family's core values. And it's very hurtful, as anyone who's had an addicted person in their family would know. And so sometimes people focus on the tough part, not the love part. And just kicking someone out of the house or just breaking off contact with an addicted person is not going to help. And so I try to help the parents frame a protocol with their teenagers in which they can express their concern, set boundaries and limits which are reasonable, offer help, but not offer things that will push the child towards more drug and alcohol use. And that gets down to specifics, like keys to the car if you're smoking marijuana, or insisting on treatment if things are really going poorly in school, or all sorts of other things that can be done, which are tough in the sense that they're boundaries, but not hurtful to the person.
You know, parents are perhaps the greatest mentors to their children. What do you say to a parent that says, I can drink alcohol or smoke cigarettes or do anything that they do, but you can't?
Yeah, what I would say to those parents is that you're giving a message which is probably not going to be very effective for you if you want to help your child with a drug or alcohol problem, and that includes marijuana. I've had parents who smoke marijuana and give it to their kids, and the parent will say, as you said, oh, I don't have a problem with marijuana. That may be true, but the child does. And so that message is going to make any treatment not particularly useful, actually, if what's going on in the house is that sort of permissiveness.
Mm-hmm. So are there any guidelines that you could give our listening audience today about how to recognize substance abuse?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's what I often talk about parents with. And I think as parents, we often know something bad is going on with our child, but we close our eyes to it. So if your child, his or her academic performance suddenly suffers, if his or her engagement with other people suffers, if he or she quits sports teams, you need to look at all those things as not just adolescent rebellion, but possibly a drug and alcohol problem. I think you need to observe your child. I mean, for the child who's falling asleep at the dinner table every night, it's not that they're tired. They might be high, right? For the child who's suddenly using money, which they hadn't in the past, that's very important to look at. If your child suddenly loses weight or gains weight, a drug or alcohol problem should come to mind first of all.
You know, that was my telephone. Unfortunately, I forgot to turn it off. Okay. So, do you relate substance abuse to, let's say, sexual addiction or overeating? And if you do, what are the similarities or dissimilarities?
Yeah, I think there are a number of similarities and a few dissimilarities. The similarities to sex addiction or food addiction are that the person has a compulsive behavior which they usually know is hurting them. I mean, the sexuality is out of control, or the eating is getting to the point where the person is harming themselves, becoming obese. And so that compulsive, out-of-control behavior is the similarity. The dissimilarity is that, of course, anyone can live the rest of their life without ever taking cocaine, and you probably can't live the rest of your life without eating or without the sexual behavior. So those are the similarities and dissimilarities.
So you say that there are some similarities, but you see dissimilarities between different types of behaviors. How does that line up with treatment? Are the treatment options available, as you understand them, different significantly between one addictive behavior and another?
Yeah, it's a good question. For the behavioral addictions like sex or eating or shopping, there aren't very many pharmacologic treatments that have much value. And for drugs and abuse, there are some things at the beginning that can be very helpful with detoxification or with getting someone into early sobriety. So for the behavioral ones like sex addiction or food addiction, there's usually more of a psychotherapeutic approach that's used, as well as using peer support models.
Okay. What is the current thinking on treatment for drug addiction with respect to outpatient treatment models or inpatient models?
The thinking is that inpatient treatment should only be used if it's absolutely needed. The reason for that is that if someone is suicidal or has a serious concurrent psychiatric problem or can't be detoxified outside of a hospital, they probably need an inpatient setting. But in my view, and most people's view, outpatient settings are better if they can be used because the person is sort of living their life and facing the same stressors they're going to face 7 days a week when they get out of inpatient. The problem with inpatient is that usually it's a safe, empathic, comfortable environment, and then when the person leaves at the end of 30 days or 90 days, the rest of the world is exactly the way it was when they left, and they haven't developed any good skills to manage that. So I usually say, if you can do outpatient, that's the first thing. If inpatient is absolutely necessary, then it's a good modality.
Do you have any idea about success rates in either inpatient or outpatient protocols with respect to curing someone of their addictive behavior?
Different facilities have different cure rates for different non-use rates, I would say, for different substances. They're usually pretty poor in the sense that if you look at 6 months or a year later, whether the person's gone back to using it again. So, but I think the best way to look at addiction is as a chronic problem like high blood pressure or diabetes. It's not that it ever gets cured, actually. It can go into remission. And I think AA is exactly right. When they say someone's in recovery, they're not recovered. So I think that it's an ongoing problem that needs to be managed. That being said, I work with people in my practice who consider themselves to be in recovery, and they haven't used for 15 or 20 years. So, you know, they're stable long-term recovery, but they're aware that their condition could come back at any time. And I think that's the best way to look at it, actually.
Since you brought up AA, one of the 12-step groups, in AA they say you'll never be cured from this disease. Like you said, you can be in recovery, but what is the likelihood that what they're doing is substituting one addiction for another? In other words, an alcoholic, they get him not to use alcohol, but now he's addicted to the meetings or to the caffeine or to the cigarettes or any number of other things.
I think that does sometimes occur, where someone, their whole life becomes AA rather than enjoying their recovery from alcohol or drugs. But usually people have a much more measured response to AA and use it as a way to function in their everyday lives. And I think that's, again, on a person-by-person basis. If someone needs to go to AA every day in order to stay sober, you know, for 20 or 30 years, I'd say more power to them. But frankly, the majority of my patients go a lot at the beginning as they get into recovery, and then as they get stronger, they move away from AA and use it maybe once a week or once a month.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Tell us an example of something that you've written in your book that you think is extremely important for parents to at least be aware of as they try to deal with their teenagers and their possible substance abuse?
I think the most important thing, and I can say this as a parent of a teenager myself, is when you're confronted with something that's terribly frightening with your teenager, you have to step back and gather yourself before you respond, because we can all respond in an angry way to a teenager who's lying or cheating. We can all respond in a very forceful way when we're afraid for our teenager's well-being. So I think parents have to step back for a moment, gather themselves, and one hopes with help from a partner, or at least from other people in the family, try to manage the problem in a way that's as effective as possible for the teenager. As a psychiatrist, I hate to tell people to squelch their feelings, but this is one situation where you probably need to take a breath, count to 10, and then manage the situation and deal with your feelings elsewhere, not with the teenager.
Sounds like advice for anger management.
Exactly.
And don't say anything until you've counted to 10.
Exactly.
Our guest today is Dr. Larry Westreich, and his book is called A Parent's Guide to Teen Addiction, and it's a very good book to help you cope with the possibility of substance abuse in your teenage children and possibly some protocols that you might use to talk to them about that. Larry, where can they get a copy of your book?
My book is available through Skyhorse Publishers. It's also on Amazon.
Okay. And do you have a website associated with this book?
Skyhorse Publishing does. If you look up the name of the book along with Skyhorse Publishing, you'll see the website for the book.
Okay, great. I'm wondering if our country isn't going in the wrong direction with addiction. It seems like, despite all our concern and what we've been doing in the past, that we're getting more and more people that are addicted to various things, and in your case that you talk about a lot, substances, but also I see it in all kinds of addictive behaviors. If we used a definition of addiction, if a person has a behavior that they come to realize is hurting them or someone they love, and they can't stop it for whatever reason, then they're addicted. Is that a reasonable definition?
It is. I usually say they have compulsive behavior or compulsive substance use, but it's the same thing as you just said. Absolutely. They can't stop it.
And this could go from shoplifting to negative thinking to sexual promiscuity to anything, couldn't it?
Absolutely.
Well, I applaud you for the work that you're doing in the field and everything. Is there anything else that you'd like to talk about today? We go all over the world with this program, and I give you an opportunity to say anything that you'd like to add to the discussion that we've already had.
Yeah, I think the most important thing to remember when you're dealing with someone you care about who has an addiction problem is that there is a lot of hope, that people get better from addiction all the time, in fact, most of the time. It probably will be a longer process than you think. It's not an acute problem that you just fix like a broken leg. It's a chronic problem like diabetes or hypertension. But that doesn't mean people can't have very good outcomes and get back to their families, into their workplace, into their education in the way that we would all want them to.
What do you think about the idea that you've got to hit bottom before you're able to get cured or get well?
I don't agree with that idea. I mean, I think that unfortunately for some addicted people, bottom is death. So, you know, in the treatment field, we don't wait for someone to hit bottom. We try to raise the bottom to, you know, simply having problems at work or having physical problems or having emotional problems or having a difficulty in a relationship. And we just say, let's declare that the bottom and get you some help here before it gets worse.
What do you think about intervention?
I think the motto we've all seen on TV where the family and friends come together to give the person an ultimatum, that's the last thing you should do, not the first thing you should do. I think a better, more empathic and effective approach is to talk with the person beforehand rather than giving any kind of ultimatums.
Well, I've enjoyed talking with you today, and good luck in your work. Do you have any new projects that are coming up?
Sure. I'm always working on something new. I enjoy writing.
Yeah. Writing is great.
Yeah.
As long as you don't think that the reason that you're writing is to make money. I found out that that I've written a lot of books and I'm not rich. So
I found the same thing. It's enjoyable. I enjoy writing, but you can't expect to pay the mortgage with it.
Absolutely. Well, this is Dr. Westreich's book, A Parent's Guide to Teen Addiction. Go out and get you a copy. It's a good book. It'll help you be able to talk to your teenager. Thank you, Larry.
Thank you for having me on.
Bye.